It's one of these shows that if you ever get a chance to see it, you have to see it. I saw the original on Broadway. My girlfriend had seen it 10 times, finally dragged me to it in New York, and it was that good. You just cry away at the end when he's dying. Yeah. We'll get back to that in a minute. I left my little card at home, but thank God it's on the internet. I can follow. Okay, we're going to do mainly Montaigne today, but first I wanted to go back over those sonnets we were doing. The tape ran out, and I just want to make the point again. Let's look at page 1916 for a minute, and then I'll hit a couple of other little pages. So I started by talking about Petrarch as the guy who sort of really invented the sonnet, this poetic form, which was very popular in the English Renaissance. Italian culture was very influential in Italy. And on page 1916, you get an English poet who's writing in kind of the Italian manner. And certainly Shakespeare did this too, because England was nowhere in the Renaissance, a little backwater speaking a funny language, as opposed to mighty Florence in Italy, which had great literatures, in France, which was a great literature. England was just beginning in its culture in the 1590s when these things were written. So I did not have a good Petrarch sonnet. There's some in the book, but they just don't really illustrate his normal style, which is just love poetry, typically using these what I call oxymorons, but I don't even have an example to show you on the page. But when you read Romeo and Juliet, it becomes really important. I mean, the prologue. Did you ever do Romeo and Juliet in high school? Okay, you know the prologue comes out and speaks a 14 line unit. Okay. Which just right now is escaping me. What's the first word? Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene from ancient strife, break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. That's four-line unit, right? Then there's 10 more to go. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. Take their life. Take their life. What does that mean? A pair of star-crossed lovers. You think it means what? Because you know the end of the play, right? What do you think it means? You think it means they kill themselves. But it doesn't. It actually means they take their origins. They take their birth from forth the fatal loins of these two foes. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, see, from their parents' loins. But fate is so heavy over the play that you can hear the wrong meaning. You know, and it comes true. That's Shakespeare playing around with you. Okay. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life whose misadventure piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife. Right? Something like that. That's the first thing you write. So that's a little sonnet. Right? And then when Romeo first meets Juliet, she's standing at the party. Remember that scene at the party with, you know, Claire Danes is standing there. Leonardo DiCaprio sneaks up to her and says something like, let's see if I can get the line. Well, he speaks four lines to her. She answers four lines back. They exchange a couple of lines, and after 14 lines exactly, which is how many, the number of lines in what? In a sonnet. After 14 lines exactly, he kisses her. Okay? So the two of them sort of make up a little sonnet as they're talking. It's just, what is the first line there? What does Romeo first say there? Good pilgrim. That's talking about a shrine. Maybe I'll look it up later. I'll come to it. Anyway, so that sonnet form, very artificial, but very cute. And here we have Edmund Spenser using it in the kind of in the love tradition on page 1916. Right? Are you with me? And we went over this poem. And the main thing is that he uses simple metaphors. He's like a ship at sea who's lost his way because of the clouds are covering the North Star, which is what he sails by. Okay? That's just the cloud covering the North Star is the same as his woman or whatever she is. In fact, it's his wife getting in a bad mood. A cloudy mood, and so he loses his way. Very simple comparison. Then we looked at the Sidney poem, number 31, and we see him projecting his own misery onto the natural world. Oh, look, the moon is pale. I'm feeling mighty pale myself. I'm having troubles with the girlfriend. Who's not a girlfriend, is actually somebody else's wife. Okay? So it's kind of hard to get next to her. Right? And feeling that despair, he projects the despair onto the moon and the heavens. Right? But you can see that we're really sort of focusing on his personality here. Right? Very dramatic poem. You really hear the guy talking. You mean they have love up in heaven too? I mean, I thought maybe at least if I got out of this world, I'd get rid of my problems, right? This is, you know, it's not something like... actually, Juliet does think of this if you get into the play, but I don't want to get too complicated. She projects herself into the next world too, and doesn't... She does not kill herself to escape her problems at the end of the play. Okay, she kills herself because she figures Romeo's already there and she's going to go join him. Okay, right. So she actually looks like a good idea to her. Right. And anyway, so in this little survey, let's do it. They only give you one Shakespeare sonnet, but he wrote 152 of them. And they're frankly fairly difficult to... understand the greatness of. I've been very slow in my life. I think they're not as interesting as the plays. But let's just take a look at this one, which is actually seems to be actually addressed to a woman, which is unusual for Shakespeare's sonnets. Most of them are addressed to a young man, whom he's trying to convince to get. He's trying to convince the young man to get married and have children. It's almost as if Shakespeare is working for the young man's mother. And in fact, he may well have been. Okay, the young man is the Earl of Southampton. But there are other types of poem. There's the rival poet sonnets, and there's the dark lady sonnets. And then there are just some sonnets like this, which are sonnets. So let's just read this. My mistress, and see what he's doing. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. You've heard this one? Sonnet 130, page 1918. Coral is far more red than her lips red. So what's the trick here? He's not making extravagant claims. Okay, he's not making extravagant claims for her beauty.
He's downplaying her.
Nonetheless, in the last two lines, yet I love her. Right? She's not perfect. Okay. And yet, I'm going to do the last two lines. By heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare. And my love would be my girlfriend, this woman. Okay. Is as rare or unusual or as beautiful. Okay. The word that throws you off in this sonnet is in line 8. In some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. All I can do is, you have to trust me on this one, it did not mean reek in a bad sense in the 16th century. Okay. Admit, it smelled nice and natural. Right, that was in fact the word that was used. So there's nothing wrong with her breath. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. It's hard to detect the greatness in there. I'm not trying to, you know, do an aesthetic lesson. You read it and it's pretty smooth, it's pretty slick. I think that's the main thing, all right? And you can kind of get a sense of the slickness by comparing it to the next poem, the last sonnet we'll look at, by Giambattista Marino. I dare say this is the first time in the history of Purdue that Marino has been taught to an undergraduate class, okay? And it may be the last time. But he was an interesting guy. He was the toast of the Italian literary world. And in 1623, he published what... In 1623, you know, Shakespeare died in 1619. And his friends published all his plays in 1623. Okay? And it's called The First Folio. It's a very rare book. I mean, it's unbelievable. And when you've read a lot of Shakespeare, to think that all this stuff is sitting in that one book, and if we didn't have it, we wouldn't have half the plays. I mean, this is probably this. You know, it's like the Michelangelo's David. This is it. There's books and there's books, but 36 Shakespeare plays are on the world scale. I don't know, pretty far up there. Okay, maybe number one, right? Maybe a little argument from Homer, something like that. But in the same year, in the very same year, of course, nobody ever heard of Shakespeare outside of England. He was nothing. It took him several hundred years to get a worldwide reputation. The book that year, the book of books, the one everybody bought, printed in Paris, kings came to get the first copy, was a book called The Adonis. The Adonis, by none other than Giambattista Marino. Okay, now well forgotten, right? But at the time, he was hot. Okay, he was the man himself. And it's a story about Venus and Adonis, basically. And it's incredibly long. And it's a kind of a romantic epic in the Ariosto mode. We didn't do that much Ariosto. Now, what Marino did, the reason he's so bad, he's sometimes so bad he's good, so we have an example of that here. He takes his comparisons and his metaphors and he strains them. He makes them too much. All right, so let's see what I mean. While his lady combs her hair. Are you with me on 1918? Through waves of gold, the waves which were her hair. In case you're like, don't get it. Okay. The waves of gold. First of all, we know the hair's dyed to begin with. Okay. Second of all, he's spelling it out that the waves are her hair. A little ship of ivory sailed one day. A little ship of ivory. What is that little ship of ivory? The comb. Okay, so you guys are good at this. A hand of ivory steered it on its way. Whoa. So she's now it's referring to her skin color, through precious undulations here and there. Right? Now Spencer compared himself to a ship wandering on a cloudless night. You know, that's pretty cool. But here you take a trivial item and you invest it with a little too much significance. I don't think there's any significance at all. Okay? It's all in the comparison. And while along the tremulous surge of beauty, she drove a straight and never-ending furrow from the rows of tumbled gold, love sought to borrow chains to reduce a rebel to his duty. What? Well, somewhere as that comb, just watching her comb her hair, see, her young swain, or probably her much older guy, because this is probably written for a prostitute, okay, is falling madly in love while he's just watching her comb her hair, right? You see how creepy this is? I hope you understand. Okay. And love pops out and sort of chains him, metaphorically. My shipwrecked heart veers down to death so fast in this stormy, blonde, and gilded sea that I am caught forever in its waves at last. In golden gulfs, at least, I come to my tempestuous end on rocks of diamond pressed, a rich disaster in which submerged I die. All right, there's probably all sorts of double senses, and he's jumped on top of her or something like that. Right, but you get the idea. Not so great. So maybe that'll help you understand the Shakespeare, right? So you know something about sonnets in your survey. You can go off and read them. You can even write a paper on them if you want, because they're short. The next thing I wanted to look at was page 1959. Just quickly. Here we are in the Renaissance. We have poets, we have artists, we have thinkers. Everybody's somehow different in the Renaissance than they have been in the history of the world. And just to make it real easy, some of the kind of pattern you can use on an exam, but you know, obviously if you push this stuff too hard, it doesn't work. We've really had three phases in the course, right? If you think back to the classics, to Homer or to Virgil, and you think of where did we locate human beings in the big world? Basically, human beings are just toys of the gods. They just get smashed down and they die. People die every page in Homer, and he just doesn't get worked up about it. That's just the way it is. You go out there, you take a spear in the head, and you die. By the way, how many of you have seen the 300? Yeah, I thought so. I finally saw it. Boy, is that it's a really interesting movie. Do you like it? Is it like good? Yeah?
Fantastic.
All right. It's got a good overall movement to it. Really, it tells its story. I mean, it's absolutely absurd to have those guys running around in leather underwear, but people like, you know, they want to see the pecs, the abs. I guess that's a big thing. Gives you something to aim for. fitness critique. But it was pretty interesting. I was sitting there going, I just couldn't believe what I was watching. But there's probably a lot more to be said about that. But that wasn't actually a very classical thing, because these are, although they were real individuals, almost in the Renaissance sense. You see, Leonidas is a supreme being. But he does die. So he just gets crushed. So that captures the classicalness really pretty well. No matter how good you are, okay, it's not good enough, and nobody really cares. Okay, and your wife is going to get raped, and the only fun is getting killed with your 300 best buddies. Okay, something like that. Or yelling, ooh, 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 when you charge into battle. And so you've seen it. So now you know why they're so upset in Iran about that movie. You guys would be able to... I mean, that Persian king, Cyrus, that's the ancient ancestor of the Shah of Iran, who was admittedly deposed, but those are Persians, modern-day Iranians. They watched that movie. And they go, no wonder they're building nuclear reactors. You They think we don't understand them, and sometimes I think they're right. Okay, based on that movie. But they don't understand, it's just a kind of comic book. So, anyway, classical period, you're crushed. The medieval period, you're kind of looking for that that union with God. See, it's not the gods anymore, these kind of crazy gods. It's God himself. So there's this constant desire to lose your identity and become one with God. That's certainly what Dante is all about. Get past the sins of the inferno and somehow get your vision. Now, that existed in, you know, it's a Platonic idea. Plato is sort of working in the same way. But, of course, he's in despair. The point of the allegory of the cave is you really can't ever get that merger with God. Okay, nobody will believe you. You'll always be thought crazy. All right. Yet in the Middle Ages, we have that sense that you can get there. If you read, we didn't look very hard at the Song of Roland, but Roland is the great Christian warrior. And by dying in battle, he's allowed to go to heaven at the end. When he dies, the angels come down and take him up to heaven. Right? So that's the sort of goal in the Middle Ages. Then we get to the Renaissance, and we suddenly get this emphasis on the human and on this world. And people don't live their lives every day waiting for the moment of death when they can get into the sort of nirvana state with God. And that's where we are right now. So it lends a sense of practicality to day-to-day life and a sense that you can get things done. You can take a block of marble and carve a David. You can take a political state and make it work just by the power of your brain, by using human reason. Right? So they get this kind of, you know, it's not every era that promotes thinking as the solution to human problems. Okay, sometimes it's gut feelings or just raw violence. Right? Want to solve problems? I mean, who wins wars? The side that's thought it out and has got the correct moral stance on an issue, or the side that's got the biggest guns and, you know, fastest jet planes? I can tell you which side wins. Right? The one with the heavier weaponry. Right? I mean, it's a hard thing to accept. We're getting to Montaigne, and that's the kind of thing he'll be talking about. Right? Well, there's this guy named Machiavelli that we're looking at here on page. What page? 1959. And he was a Florentine, same city as Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch, and living in around 1500. When various things happened and the Florentines were an independent city and they lost their independence. Mainly the Medici, the ruling family, took over and they sort of crushed the average, the democratic opposition. So you got a dukedom that was set up and the ruling family took over. So it was a loss of freedom. And Machiavelli was a freedom fighter, right? But he knew he'd lost. And he turns around in one of the great moves in history and writes a manual for the new duke, the new aristocratic tyrant, you might say, of Florence, explaining to him exactly what he needs to do in order to maintain his control. So you can see what this is, what gives Machiavelli a bad name. It's like I wrote a little book saying, you know, "Dear Vladimir Putin, you want to maintain control of Russia? You kill everyone in Uzbekistan today, not yesterday." Okay? And you're shocked by it. You're shocked. And that's what Machiavelli says. He says, you've got power, you got to use it. Okay? But you got to be careful too. You have to use it correctly. And maybe killing everybody, which works, I admit, works. Maybe it's not the best thing because, the tax income kind of goes down. Right? So what you want to do is you're much better off scaring the hell out of them. Okay? This is freaky advice. See, but you get up there, you know, power corrupts. you got all the seething masses and you're trying to run your dictatorship, you'll take almost any kind of advice. And Machiavelli gives him this advice, right? Now, this is the Italian Renaissance, so we really don't know if Machiavelli really meant this, or if he meant, like, the average person to read it and say, this is the kind of thinking that tyrant's doing. You know, he may pretend he loves us, but he really doesn't because he's following us. So we don't know. It's not clear Machiavelli sold out to the ruling power, okay? Right? I mean, for all I know, Karl Rove is in fact a liberal Democrat, right? He's going to come at him. He's purposely done everything he's done, right? But that would be a Machiavellian way of looking at it. Okay, in other words, push the tyrant into making some serious mistakes. Right? Well, anyway, he wrote the book, and so it's a fascinating book. And if you study political science, you read it. And I just thought I'd just pick out one. One image, because he on page 1957, let's start there. Chapter 25 is subtitled "Fortune is a Woman." This has been a little theme running through the class, so I thought I'd pick this up. We've seen fortune images. Remember in Percival, Fortune comes up to Percival. She's an old hag. She's bald behind. She's got the forelock. I showed you some fortune images in Hamlet. And I talked about how Fortune is for Dante was the ruling deity of the earth, where Mars, the war god, is the deity of Mars, and each planet has a deity. It was really, Dante first said that fortune or change is really what characterizes the earth. Today I'm rich, tomorrow I'm poor. Everything changes. Well, Machiavelli is warning the prince, the tyrant, the prince, that you better watch out for fortune. Right? Classically, the fortune goes along with war. Right? You say war is where fortune rules supreme. You think you got it all figured out, you don't. Okay, everything looks rosy. Suddenly, all hell's breaking loose. That's just the classic Renaissance view of once you start down that road, you are really throwing yourself on fortune. And so that he's trying to attract the prince's attention, and he says fortune is a woman. In other words, don't put yourself in situations where you're relying on stability. Okay, the idea here is that she's unstable. So we can see that at the top of 1958. Now, we don't believe this ourselves. Let's step right back. But they were still... the feminist thought had not caught up with the Renaissance, although it wasn't completely absent either, right? By any means. In the third line on 1958, so the same is true of fortune. She shows her power where there is no wise preparation for resisting her, and turns her fury where she knows that no walls and dikes have been made to hold her. And if you consider Italy, the place where these variations occur and the cause that has set them in motion, you will see that she is a country without dikes and without any wall of defense. Italy was famously overrun by armies in the 1600s. So if, like Germany, Spain, and France, she had a sufficient bulwark of military vigor, this flood would not have made the great changes that it has, this flood of armies. Now, let's look over on page 1959, right in the middle of the page. The paragraph that starts, I conclude that since fortune is variable and men are set in their ways, they are successful when they are in harmony with fortune and unsuccessful when they disagree with her. Yet I am of the opinion that it is better to be rash than overcautious, because fortune is a woman, and if you wish to keep her down, you must beat her and pound her. Well, let's just mull that one over for a little. Okay. You must beat her and pound her. It's not clear that that's not the way he treated his wife, but I'm not sure it is. Or whether this is the way he thinks you have to talk to a prince, because you got to talk kind of macho to these guys so they don't pay any attention to you. Or whether he's not interested in women at all. He's just telling them how to handle fortune. Okay.
He just read the Quran.
He might have just read the Quran, And he might have just read the Arabian Nights for all I know, because I didn't. In the passage, I didn't go over at the beginning when Scheherazade offers to decide she's going to go marry the Shahryar and tell him stories, right, to keep other women from being murdered in the morning. Her father says to her, "You're mad. Don't do that." And he starts telling her a story about a donkey and an ox and something like that. But the point of it is, he says to her, and he tells her a second story about a merchant who is taught by the donkey that the way to control his wife is to lock her in a room and beat her up. Okay, that's actually page. You can mark that on page 17. Where is this? Yeah, 1782. You want wife-beating passages here in the anthology? There, on page 1782. So the father says to his daughter, "You know, I really don't want you to marry that king because he's going to kill you." And Scheherazade says, "Well, I'm going to do it anyway." And the father says to her, "You know, you're just a woman. You're only a daughter. I should treat you the way they say you should treat your wife, which is when she doesn't do what you want, beat her up." So the father threatens the daughter, threatens Scheherazade that he's going to beat her up. Okay? Might as well look at that. Right, you see on page 1782? Right after the space, about a third of the way down. "If you don't relent, I shall do to you what the merchant did to his wife," says his father. So he's threatening his daughter. Her answer? She said, "Such tales don't deter me from my request. If you wish, I can tell you many such tales." Tales of wife beating, says Scheherazade. "Ha! I spit on it. Spit on you, Dad." Okay. "In the end, if you don't take me to King Shahryar, I shall go to him by myself, behind your back, and tell him that you have refused to give me to one like him, and that you have begrudged your master one like me. A little blackmail goes a long way." Okay? She has no problem handling violent old dad. Okay? And I think the implication is that this is the normal way of social proceeding. Okay? That violence, everybody can threaten violence, but there's lots of ways to get revenge. Lots of ways. Just tell the neighbors that guy down there is Al-Qaeda. "Can we just check that one more time? Are you sure he was okay?" "Nah, he owed me $50. Which is what, unfortunately, when you don't, that's what's going on over there. Anyway, so there we go. There's your fortune images in Machiavelli, right? Two other passages before we get to Montaigne. I had it on a card. This is on the website. I'm looking at, if you go to the course syllabus, these pages will be there. Erasmus, page 1943. So we're in the Renaissance, and our 1943. Our theme here is this sort of growth of this notion that human beings and the idealism doesn't have to exist in a supernatural realm, but sort of operates on Earth. And that reason is somehow supreme. Now, the counterexample, actually, is this guy named Erasmus. Erasmus. You see him at the top of the page? E-R-A-S-M-U-S. It's a name you haven't heard of. Yes, anybody ever heard of this guy? He sort of just disappeared from history. But he is one of the most important thinkers in the last 1,000 years. But his message is essentially lost, right? He was a good guy. He wrote enormous amounts. He translated. He was the first guy to translate, to produce an edition of the New Testament in Greek with a Latin translation. So he's a real scholar. And he did that in 3 years. I mean, just when he decided he needed it, he went out and learned Greek. And this is just one of many projects he did. He wrote collections of sayings, and he essentially established the curriculum for grammar schools that was used for the next 300 years, basically, which young men learning Latin. what it was. Right? But at the time of the Reformation, he stood against Luther because he deeply believed in the Catholic Church. But he believed in it in a certain way. And what he believed, he was a man of really strong faith. And he believed faith did everything. That you couldn't reason your way to God. And this is what this book is called, The Praise of Folly, is about. It's good to be foolish. Okay. As my mother used to say, you think you're so smart, it doesn't do you any good. Okay. You can be too smart for your own good, according to this view, according to Erasmus. And let's just look in the first new paragraph on 1943. Now to stop running through endless examples and to put it in a nutshell, it seems to me that the Christian religion taken altogether has a certain affinity with some sort of folly and has little or nothing to do with wisdom. If you want proof of this, notice first of all that children, old people, women, and retarded persons are more delighted than others with holy and religious matters and hence are always nearest to the altar, simply out of way of a natural inclination. Moreover, you see how those first founders of religion were remarkably devoted to simplicity and bitterly hostile to literature. Finally, no fools seem more senseless than those people who have been completely taken up once and for all with a burning devotion to Christian piety. They throw away their possessions, ignore injuries, allow themselves to be deceived, make no distinction between friend and foe, shudder at the thought of pleasure, find satisfaction in fast vigils, tears, and labor, shrink from life, desire death above all else. In short, they seem completely devoid of normal human responses, just as their minds were living somewhere else, not their bodies. They're thinking too much about it. Okay, it's just getting too complicated. And he's saying, keep it simple, right? Keep it childlike. Be foolish. This is a very powerful notion in the 16th century when you had the wars of religion raging between Catholics and Protestants. And it was as bad could be. You don't know the extent of it. But we're going to Montaigne, and he's living in the middle of these religious wars in France. It's exactly like what's going on in the Arab world today. I mean, it is bad, all right? People are dying by the thousands. Armies are moving across the landscape. It's just took 100 years to really burn out. It wasn't until the middle of the 17th century. And Erasmus's view is the violence makes no sense because you're fighting over something when you can't know anything, all right? So just keep it simple, foolish, childlike. So you could probably argue that's a kind of human ideal, too, in an odd form. In the history of literature, it explains the presence of characters who are fools themselves in literature in the 16th century. Don Quixote will be the supreme example. That's where we're going today. A foolish old man who thinks he's a knight-errant, who thinks windmills are giants. He couldn't be more wrong. He's crazy. Yet somehow, some weird way, he got it right. Okay? There's something right about the way he sees the world. Because he sees it in terms of this ideal, chivalric way of life that can't possibly exist anywhere. Right? He looks at Dulcinea, who's a two-bit slut in a town, you know, and he starts calling her Dulcinea, the sweetest one. And he's treating her like a woman, and eventually she turns into one. So the completely false idea, right, suddenly becomes real. The foolishness pays off. Very powerful idea, right? We get this in Shakespeare's King Lear. He's got a fool by him. The fool figure shows up in a number of Shakespeare's plays, and of course they're always spouting nonsense that turns out to be right. Okay, and somehow you don't want to think too hard. You think too hard, you're like Machiavelli. So you want this notion of foolishness. I should probably jump right to the Montaigne now, but I have one more poem. So hold that thought, and let's just look at page 2048. And this is or 2049. Oh, he has some more poems by Spencer. The poet I want to mention is John Donne. Not one of my favorites, but most people just love him. I'm weird, right? Just John Donne. He lives in Shakespeare's time, and he combines both the ultra-religious and the ultra-sensual in one person. Okay, so we get... In fact, he seemed to be two different people almost. Sort of a great lover, family man, and then he became the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral and the greatest preacher of his age. And we have his sermons are still extant. He had such lines as, "Death be not proud, for some have called thee." Have you ever heard of that? Or, "For whom the bell tolls," the Hemingway. That's a line from Donne. So he was a great preacher. Well, here you have a bit of his eroticism in these poems. So I thought I'm not going to go over them, but maybe we just need a little. To his mistress going to bed. So here's that. In this case, it's probably not a prostitute. Probably is his wife. He was quite in love with his wife, and she had like 10 kids, and then actually about 16. Then she died, and he got religion. I don't know. You can read the poem yourself. He's sort of taking delight in undressing her, and the key line is line 25. Because it brings in the theme. This is 100 years after Columbus discovered America, but we feel we're in the Renaissance, this idea of new worlds, new things to learn, new ways of doing stuff. "License my roving hands." Roving hands, right? "And let them go before, behind, between, above, below. Oh, my America," he says to her. Just a little metaphor. He's wandering over her the way explorers wander over America. "Oh, my America, my newfound land, my kingdom, safest when with one man manned." In other words, I hope I'm the only guy you're seeing. Okay. All right. "My mine of precious stones, my empery, how I am blessed in thus discovering thee." All right. So people like that poem. And then... for some of you, this may be your only English course, so let's give you one more poem. "The Flea," at the bottom of the page. This is called a metaphysical conceit. Remember Marino with the way he did the comb and the hair? Here he takes an image of a flea that bites both him and his girlfriend, and in that flea, therefore, their bloods mingle. And he finds that as a really... great image of their unity together, of their mutual love, the blood mingling. See, and it's kind of a strained image. So we call it a metaphysical image. That's what the... And there's a whole bunch of people called metaphysical poets, which if you take English 240 or an English course, you might read. But you can see that the wit and the... He's using his cleverness here almost as much as his emotion. Right. "Mark but this flea, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee, and in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Therefore, let's mingle the rest of us." It's basically the argument. Okay, so you can read that on your own. All right. Any questions? You get that was a little history of poetry. Now let's do Montaigne, who's on page 2178. And I gotta say, I hadn't been reading him lately, 2178. But I feel like completely remiss, you know, that I'm not, you know, waving this in the face of like every dean at Purdue. This is stuff everybody should read. It's one of the great thinkers of all time, including me. And we forget to reread our Montaigne. And you're not going to understand. I don't understand everything about him. But he wrote hundreds and hundreds of essays. He invented the essay form. And he thought about topics with a freshness and a clearness of head that is remarkable in the history of the world and still salutary for us as we're caught up in trying to figure out what's going on around us. And most of us can't do a very good job of it. It's interesting to see Montaigne trying to figure out the world, too. These essays, this comes from the French to try, essayes, to try. All right. So an essay is a try. So what he's trying to do is think about a topic, okay, various topics. And they mainly, if you were in the Middle Ages and you were reading someone like St. Thomas Aquinas, you'd be trying to figure out God, how many angels can you put on the head of a pin, how big is God, how old is he, this stuff. That's not what Montaigne's doing. He's thinking about himself, which is himself as a representative person, okay, and trying to figure out who he is. And he's using prose to think through a point. This is why we write essays ourselves, why I assign essays. I don't know. Because you don't know the answer in advance, and you by writing this stuff up, you think through a topic, okay? You can use stories to think about things, okay? I can think about the sinful nature of man. I can think about my relationship to my son by telling a story of Isaac, Abraham and Isaac, right? I tell a story. I sort of, you know, I try and figure out stuff. But you can also just figure it out in prose, and that's what Montaigne is doing. So on 2178, you get some notes. Let me make a few comments. To think about things, he's always going to the classics. He's reading ancient Greek and Roman writers. A lot of Plutarch and his Plato. But he's very aware, this is the key thing to get out of page 2178, he's very aware that life has changed a lot between the ancient Romans and his life in France in 1500, which isn't that long ago. So he's a lot closer to us. You can still go to Bordeaux and see his big house. When Dante looked back at ancient Rome, Dante in the Middle Ages looked back at ancient Rome, it was like it was yesterday. He wouldn't think there was a lot of difference between Julius Caesar and a local pope. When Montaigne looked back, it looked like a long way off. He had a real sense of history. Okay, so this kind of awareness is very different in the Renaissance. And one of the reasons that I can't to the list of things that separate the Renaissance from the Middle Ages, one of them was raw textual scholarship. People were very good. They unearthed a lot of manuscripts that the Middle Ages didn't know. The Middle Ages didn't know Homer, for example. They didn't know the history of the Latin language. They didn't know that it changed. The most famous example of this was a document called the Donation of Constantine. You don't need this, folks. Why not? Emperor Constantine, when he moved, remember he moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople in about 325? According to this document, when the Romans basically left Rome and set up the Eastern Empire and the Greek side of the Roman Empire in Constantinople, modern Istanbul, okay, where it lasted until 1425, Constantine donated the land and all the power he left behind to the Pope. And that was the basis of papal power, a guy like Julius II running around conquering Bologna. Right? The Donation of Constantine. So they actually had a document allegedly written by the emperor in 325 AD giving this power to the Pope, because everything has to be grounded somewhere. I mean, all authority has to be grounded. We ground it in the Constitution. Okay, England grounds it in tradition. I mean, you got to have something that you go back to. Well, people went back, the papal power went back to this document, in other words, the secular power. I mean, the Pope always has control over your soul, but what, you know, income from your farm, he gets from this, right? Well, in 1475, an Italian scholar looking at this document noticed that there were a lot of words in it that couldn't possibly have been written in 325 because there's no evidence that they were used earlier than, say, 1150. And just by looking at the Latin, he's able to prove this document is a forgery and a fraud. Right? Forgery and a fraud. So that changes the Renaissance. You get a real skepticism coming in about documents. You get a real, the beginning of scientific thinking, that's on a scholarly way, but modern science isn't too far away. I mean, Boyle, the father of modern chemistry, is 1625. All right? So, right. That's enough for this new... this new sense of skepticism and a new concentration on the self. So let's look at the first essay, which is The Power of Imagination, on page 2182. And I told you, I mean, I just really shocked. Of the 300 essays they could have assigned, this one is really strange. What is the power of the imagination? The example he does is... at the end of last class, I said, I'm going to concentrate really hard. I'm just going to lift all you guys up about 6 inches. All right, everybody, like seance. Let's see if we can get our brains working, whether we can move this thing. Well, that's... I failed, I'm sorry. But speaking of failure, please be here. There's no class on Thursday, right? No class Thursday, but be here on Tuesday, because that's when you do the teaching evaluations. So I might even take attendance. I want you there. I don't care what you say, but I just want you there to say it. All right? I do care what you say, because I look at it to figure out how to change the class, if there's a change needed. Hard to imagine. But, so be there, and then, you know, maybe the bonus point come out of it. Who knows? But you won't know if you're not there. So that's Tuesday. So here we are in The Power of Imagination. And of the 300 essays you could have put in for Montaigne, they put in this one. And on 2184, it's clear why he's obsessed with this. And I don't want to really talk about it, but your mind controls your sexual urges, let's put it that way. And that's what he's talking about. And he seems really hung up. He gives you lots of examples of men who need a little work on their imagination, let's put it that way. Okay? Need a little work on that. And he gives some examples which you can't... the young bridegroom thrown into a room with a woman he's probably never met before, surrounded by friends partying. And in those days, they sat right in the room and they put you in a curtained bed, right? And it was clear there was disastrous results, enough so that Montaigne felt the need to write an essay on this and on the power of the imagination, okay? And he said what he used to do when his friend would be worried about, you know, whether he'd be in the mood when he's thrown into the bed with this woman, he would give him a little gold coin and say, "This has miraculous powers." Okay? And the guy would like put it in his pocket and say, and believe deeply in the miraculous powers of the thing, and suddenly it would work. Right? So miracles, he's saying, are examples of the imagination at work. Imagination at work. So it suddenly becomes a really interesting essay. It's not just like just about sex, but it's about a larger sense of beliefs. And on page 2187, he starts talking about how doctors work. And I think this is a very modern conception that we know, you know, that most of your nature takes care of most of your illnesses. Not all of them. But, you know, what you think or how you're handle, the bedside manner of a doctor can get people believing in a certain way so that perhaps they can get cured. All right? anyway, you can, let's see what else they have on that. My view of this is imagination can produce physical changes, and it gives the example of impotence. Montaigne makes up a story about an omelet charm to keep a young husband from impotence the night of his wedding, where rivals are present. It's not just the other guys there, but there's like, you know, bigger guys who are bigger and stronger than you are, stuff like that. Then he gives the example of the doctor's bedside manner on 2187. He gives an example of a woman who has swallowed a pin on 2188. Let's look at that. Right at the top of the page. A woman, thinking she had swallowed a pin with her bread, was screaming in agony as though she had an unbearable pain in her throat where she thought she felt it stuck. But because externally there was neither swelling nor alteration, a smart man, judging that it was only a fancy, a notion derived from some bit of bread that had scratched her as it went down, made her vomit, and on the slide,